2012, February 10th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 26, The Deserts of Mars. Keep going. Today we're going to now, we've set the stage. We've looked at this planet of the solar system, we've talked about the requirements for life, and now we're going to go through the best prospects we think we have in our solar system for where we might look for life. I can tell you the answer right away. We have not yet found convincing evidence of life on at least the planet Mars, and we haven't yet been able to look at the other two bodies where we think are promising, namely the Europa and the moon Enceladus of Saturn. But we still are going to be looking for Mars, because Mars still is probably one of the best prospects, if not for life today, perhaps life in the distant past. And that's one of the reasons why the planet Mars has been the subject of intense investigation by NASA over the last few decades, and will continue to be so over the next, for at least the conceivable future. Today, this is the beginning of a two-part section on Mars. Today, we're going to talk about the planet as it is today, and a little bit about what its past must have been like. And on Monday, we're going to talk about what the details are of life on Mars and where our current thinking is on that particular topic. So today we're going to be looking at the properties of the desert planet Mars. The first thing is just a basic fact. Mars is the fourth planet from the Sun, and it's about half the size of the Earth. We're going to be looking at an old, cold, geologically inactive world. Mars has a very, very thin, dry atmosphere. It's very cold. It's mostly carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And we have polar caps on this planet that consists of both water ice and carbon dioxide ice, in other words, dry ice. It's cold enough on Mars that carbon dioxide snows out of the atmosphere at the poles. The surface of Mars is a cold, dry desert. And we only think of deserts as being hot, but in fact, a lot of deserts on the Earth, in fact, the driest deserts on the Earth are cold, and it's the dry that's important here. We do see extinct volcanoes. We do see signs of past geologic activity, but it looks like that activity ended in the last 300 million years. The other thing that's happened over the last probably decade, where we've sent very high-resolution imagers orbiting the planet Mars, is we've found evidence of at least past water flows. Used to be thought there were just floods, but in fact, recently we've begun to get significant amounts of evidence that there were steady-state flows seen, where you actually see meandering rivers and things that look like river deltas, but they're very ancient terrain. We also have begun to get some evidence now of very substantial subsurface ice deposits on the planet Mars. I'll show some pictures at the very end of that. And there's lots of evidence coming from the Mars rovers, where we can actually get right up close to the rocks on the surface of the planet, where we see sedimentary rocks, and we're finding minerals that were formed in the presence of liquid water. We're finding hydrated minerals. So all of these pieces together are starting to point to the fact that while Mars is a cold, dry desert today, there is significant evidence that it was probably warm and wetter, perhaps even in a boat of liquid water, maybe not in the near past, but during its first billion years ago or so of its life. So 3.5 billion years has elapsed since that first billion years. So it's been a very, very long time since Mars was a place that might, and I underline the word might, have been a possible abode for life. This makes it a possible source for intensive study, because we may be looking for either current survivals, because we know there are extremophiles that can survive underground and under fairly extreme conditions, as long as there may be some subsurface water. Or we may be looking for fossils. What we don't know, are we looking for fossils or fauna? And that's a subject we'll pick up on Monday. But today I want to lay down the fundamentals we need to know what the place is we're going to be visiting. As I said at the beginning, we've had a tremendous amount of effort has been expended by the United States and the Soviet Union, and more recently by the European Space Agency, on studying the planet Mars. We have now placed four successful landers on the surface of Mars. Two, three, four. No, that's five now. Gosh, I'm starting to lose count. We currently have high-resolution imagers in orbit around the planet, which are able to map out the planet in tremendous detail, down to sizes of a few meters. They also carry instruments which are able to probe for subsurface water using gamma-ray sensors. They can probe gravity. They can probe altitude. We've mapped out the surface of Mars now in tremendous detail. We've landed landers at mostly the equatorial regions, and one successful lander up near the poles, the Phoenix lander. We've also crashed a couple into the planet, too, so it's not been 100% hit rate. The more recent Mars missions that have gone to the surface of a particular interest, instead of being a single lander that sits in one place, have carried robotic rovers that are able to travel around the planet. The first of these was the Sojourner rover, which was a very small unit. It was only about, the size of a small suitcase, and traveled only a very short distance. More recently on the surface, much outliving their design lifetime by many, many years, are the Mars Exploration Rovers, which were named Spirit and Opportunity. Spirit has recently gone offline and does not actually look like it's going to be revived. It basically has gotten too cold. Its solar panels up here collect dust and eventually get like dirty solar panels, become less and less effective. It's a long ways away and it's very cold. If the heaters can't keep the electronics working, they eventually go out. They can't get enough power. Opportunity, on the other hand, seems to be doing pretty good. In fact, it's just been parked for the Martian winter for the place where it is. They actually are driving it up a slope, so its solar panels will be better facing the winter sun. And they're hoping, keeping their fingers crossed, that it actually survives through the winter and can be revived in the following Martian spring. There's a new Mars rover on its way to the red planet now. It was launched in November. This Mars Exploration Laboratory is much bigger. It's actually about the size of a Mini Cooper and will be able to travel over a much larger area of the planet. It's carrying geological and basic biological experiments. It's going to a particular site that's been identified as a place where there are significant signs of liquid water in the past. So it's a very targeted mission, and it's not the last. There's going to be a lot more missions planning ahead. Yes, ma'am? It takes a little under a year to reach Mars. You play this little game with a transfer orbit to make it come into place. But it's actually there's a couple of limited windows where when you launch it, it will catch up with Mars when Earth and Mars are in about the right part of the solar system. So there's sort of a launch season. That's why you always see these things coming out in pairs. Yeah. The success rate for landing probes has been pretty good. There have been two spectacular failures, one of which was an American probe, which was originally to go to the poles. They made a significant mistake in the piece that was supposed to detach the parachute, and then it was going to detach from the parachute and fire engines. The parachute detached too soon and piled in. That was not so good. So that was the Mars Polar Lander. Phoenix was the replacement for the Mars Polar Lander mission. And then the Soviets had one in the 1970s that basically just piled it in. There's also been a lack of success in putting orbiters in. There was one American orbiter that was supposed to swing around and do an aerobraking. You come in pretty fast. So the way you slow down, instead of carrying tons of fuel with you, which is very expensive and expensive in weight, because you want to maximize the weight of your spacecraft. So the idea was you were going to blow through the upper atmosphere and use the atmospheric drag to slow you down. It's called aerobraking. It's a really cool technique that's used for all the recent Mars missions. Somewhere in the engineering specifications, one of the documents said that it was specified doing things in metric units of force, which are newtons, and someone actually at the aerospace thing interpreted it as pounds of force. So they missed up English and metric units, and it ended up coming in at exactly the wrong angle. The thrusters basically were running at the wrong thrust rating, and so the thing came in at a much shallower angle and basically burned up in the atmosphere. Oh, that was wrong. So it all braked, but not in the way they wanted to. The Soviets have had a terrible time with Mars probes. The one that just went into the Pacific not too long ago, a couple months ago, didn't even get out of Earth orbit. And the Soviets have actually flown a few that have died partway out. So it's been a tough... Mars is a tough place to work. not always because it's a harsh environment, because it's been really hard. All right. Other questions? Cool. All right. Oops. So let's start with the Martian atmosphere. The Martian atmosphere is extremely thin, extremely dry, and composed of mostly carbon dioxide. The proportions of the constituents are 95% carbon dioxide, 2.7% nitrogen, about 1.6% argon, with bare traces, 0.03%, 0.03 ten-thousandths. Of a trace of water vapor, so it's extremely dry. Contrast that with the Earth, which is 78% nitrogen, 20% oxygen, O2, and only traces of water vapor and carbon dioxide. So this is an atmosphere which is very close in terms of the carbon dioxide being the dominant constituent, is telling you this is still pretty much a primordial-like atmosphere. It's very much more like what the Earth's atmosphere was like originally, But remember, the Earth's atmosphere scrubbed most of its carbon dioxide out through the water and carbon dioxide cycle. So something like that probably did not occur on Mars. And in fact, Mars has lost a substantial amount of its atmosphere. The current air pressure at the surface of Mars is 7,000ths the air pressure on the surface of the Earth. That's equivalent to being on Earth at an altitude of 30 kilometers, so up in the stratosphere. You've just exited the troposphere and you're into the stratosphere. And that means pretty much we could not walk around on the surface of Mars without breathing apparatus. It's impossible to breathe. Human beings really can't survive very well, actually not very well at all, or of 6 kilometers, much less 30 kilometers. So if you remember the problem you had to do a little while ago, where for every, in round number, 6 kilometers, you go up an atmosphere, you drop off by half, that's 5 halves, or 1/32nd. So it's getting down there. It's a pretty small fraction. Actually, it's a little bit worse than that, because it's 5.6. This is a nice picture from one of the Mars orbiters. It shows the cross-section. Here's the limb of Mars, and you can see this very thin atmosphere. The reason why you can see the shell here is Mars usually is covered by dust storms fairly often, and there's a lot of suspended aerosol particles. Those aerosol particles are red because they're iron oxide, among other things. And so what you're seeing is the suspended dust at the top of what passes for the troposphere of Mars. So it very nicely lays out that the Mars atmosphere is this very, very thin, very, very bone-dry carbon dioxide atmosphere. And it's really cold there. The typical weather on Mars, but even though it's a thin atmosphere, it's enough for Mars to have weather and weathering, although it's just not going to be very intense. The basic weather on Mars is breezy and cold. If you want to know the Mars forecast, and for a while on Phoenix website, they would have a little daily weather report, although they would do it in terms of sols. Sols is one rotation of the planet Mars. So they don't talk about days because Mars rotates at about 25 hours in round numbers compared to 24 hours for the Earth. So they talk about a Mars day as being a sol. You get used to it. So on Sol 17, after the landing of the Phoenix lander, which was up near one of the poles, it had a little weather station on it. And so they would have the daily weather report from Mars. And so you can see that the max temperature was 26 degrees below Celsius. That's minus 15 Fahrenheit. The minimum temperature at night was minus 116 Fahrenheit, so very large day-to-night variations. Thin atmosphere, you get a lot of radiative cooling involved. The air pressure was 8.35 millibars, which is 0.007 atmospheres. So really, really low atmosphere, but a fairly substantial wind. It was about an 8-mile-an-hour wind coming out of the southwest. And this is what you get on Mars. The typical wind speeds are about 11 miles an hour, I'm sorry for the English, but 17 kilometers an hour, can gust up to 30 kilometers an hour. And actually, the gusts can kick up very large dust storms. Sometimes these gusty winds lead to the formation of dust devils. This is a sequence of pictures that was taken from one of the Mars rovers, which carried a relatively fast camera. And if you watch around here, you'll suddenly see a dust devil begin to form. A dust devil is a little vortex. It's kind of like a mini dry air tornado that's driven by thermal motions. I grew up in the Mojave Desert of California. We'd see dust devils all the time. And it was really cool to see. There's tons of pictures of dust devils on Mars. They look a lot like the dust devils I grew up with in the Mojave Desert. And they're a common feature of a thermally heated atmosphere with wind. So it actually does have weather, and there is weathering in the sense that you do get erosion. You do get a lot of aeolian kinds of processes, as they're called, which is basically going to erode surface features. The wind sometimes, however, can get quite extreme. And occasionally, if everything lines up just right, in terms of the speed of the wind, how close you are to the sun, so how much thermal heating you get, you can actually get planet-wide dust storms. So here's a pair of pictures that were taken with the Hubble Space Telescope. The first one is a pretty much normal picture taken in about June 26th. You can see the poles are fairly large here. The poles are usually covered with ice as you come out of winter. You can see some very thin high clouds in the atmosphere. And then 3 months later, the winds kick up. A lot of the winds on Mars are north-south or south-to-north. And because they're actually driven by condensation of carbon dioxide on the winter pole and evaporation of carbon dioxide off the summer pole. And so you get very large global shifts in pressure, and you get these global flows. And occasionally they can kick up dust if there's enough thermal activity to pump up the dust. That's the same planet, but almost completely obscured by this planet-wide dust storm, sort of a haboob written large, which is a very large dust storms on Earth. There's a famous story, I think it was Mariner 9. It was one of the first second or third spacecraft sent by Mars. I remember when I was a kid, I saw Mariner 7 was the first spacecraft that went by Mars carrying a video camera. It just flew by. They didn't try to orbit. They just simply blew it past and took pictures. And it was really cool, but the video quality was kind of 60s. So in Mariner 9, everyone was real excited because it was a really what then passed for a high-resolution camera. It'd be like going up with high-def today. And everyone was real excited. And just before Mariner 9 got there, one of these planet-wide dust storms blew up. And Mariner 9 blows by the planet, and there's nothing to see but a dust storm. Yeah, I don't know how many millions of dollars were sent blowing past that. That's when they started thinking, maybe we should go into orbit and stay there for a while. And certainly that was what the next generation of spacecraft did. The poles are very important and they're very interesting. They're part of the cycling of water and carbon dioxide on Mars. Mars has two very strongly visible poles, north and south. They were seen on telescopes from the Earth in the 18th century. They consist primarily of water ice and carbon dioxide ice. So we are getting temperatures now, which is getting cold enough that carbon dioxide basically condenses out as dry ice. The poles grow in the winter, shrink in the summer. The Mars is tilted on its axis by 25 degrees. That's pretty close to, similar to what the Earth is. Earth is about 23.5 degrees. So you get very strong seasonal variations as you go through one Martian orbit, which is about 1.8 years. Mars is a much more elliptical orbit, so sometimes it's a little bit closer to the sun, sometimes it's further away, so you get some additional amplification of the seasons. And so the poles kind of grow in size and shrink depending upon those seasonal variations. A lot of the rivulet you see here is there's actually sort of these patternings of shrinking, of freezing out and then shrinking back, falling up, growing out and shrinking back. These are very important for driving the Martian weather because Mars's atmosphere is so thin that when carbon dioxide begins to evaporate or sublimate, goes from ice to gas directly off of the summer pole, you dump an awful lot of a very large fraction of carbon dioxide in the Mars atmosphere. Meanwhile, on the opposite, the winter pole, the carbon dioxide is beginning to come out of the atmosphere. So you get high pressure where it's getting sublimated, you're getting low pressure where it's freezing out. High pressure always flows towards low pressure, and you can get these very large winds driven across the planet. It's very different kinds of weather than we're used to seeing, but it's weather nonetheless. Let's look inside the planet for a second. We actually know something. We're starting to learn more, but we're starting to learn something about the interior of the planet. The landers do carry a minimum seismographic capability, and certainly in the future, instrumenting the planet with seismographs will give us a better idea. We're going to be looking for minor Mars quakes. Even though the planet is geologically inactive, as it cools, it shrinks a little bit, and you do build up stresses, and you have very, very deep cracking. We see that in the moon as well. There are moon quakes, and there are certainly Mars quakes. Also, when a meteor punches into the surface, that makes a nice little boom on one part and sends seismic waves out. So you can probe the interior. Right now, the idea is that Mars is pretty much solidified all the way through. The mantle is solid, and the inner core has also long since solidified. It's not surprising. It's a small body. It's half the size of the Earth. It cools off much more rapidly than the Earth. And so even though the Earth is nice and molten on the inside now, Mars is not. Mars is cold on the inside. So what does this give you? It means the crust is going to be very thick. It's a lot thicker in proportion to the size of Mars. Our own crust is almost like a thin eggshell compared to the size of the Earth right now because of the molten interior. It's cold and it's rigid. It's one big piece. This rigidity makes it basically a little bit fragile. It is subject to some kind of processing as the system shrinks. You end up with two crusts on the planet of Mars. The first of these is the primary crust that has been shaped by impacts that have been whacking Mars just like it's been whacking every other solid body in the solar system for the last 4.5 billion years. You see some very large impact basins that are left over from the last epoch of heavy bombardment, and you see some relatively recent meteoritic activity as well. Mars has a thin atmosphere, so rocks don't burn up in the atmosphere of Mars like they do on the Earth. So a few meter-sized meteor hitting the Earth will actually burn up in the high atmosphere. A few meter rock going into Mars, bam, smacks right into the surface. However, in addition to this primary crust, this built up by impacts like we see on Mercury and the Moon, we also have a secondary crust, which has been shaped by active volcanism in the planet's past. We see areas that are very smooth, that have been repaved over. that have a smaller number of craters in them because they're newer terrains. And on the case of Mars, we actually see extinct shield volcanoes. Here's a kind of an unwrapping of Mars. We're going to now take the globe and we're going to unwrap it into a nice flat map. And here what we're doing is we're using data from a laser altimeter that was on one of the Mars orbiters. It was called the MOLA instrument, the Mars Orbiter Laser Altimeter Experiment. As the orbiter was basically an orbit that went up over the poles, so it would process around and slowly scan and build up a picture of the planet. It used a laser altimeter to measure the height of the terrain immediately below where the spacecraft was flying, and it built up this three-dimensional terrain map. The colors here are coded so that red are highlands. They're higher than the average spheroid of the surface of the planet. And the blue are the lowlands. They're places where the terrain is deeply depressed. The white here, these very bright spots, these three spots in a row and there, are in fact four shield volcanoes. This is the famous Tharsis Ridge. It's a high plateau, and you can see how this entire plateau has been pushed up. This is an example of ancient vertical tectonism. Basically, you have an upwelling, which has been pushing up this mound. There's a magma hotspot underneath this about at least 300 million years ago and later. Some of that magma broke through the surface and built up gigantic shield volcanoes. You also see deep cracking and rifts. This is the Valles Marineris. This is an example of a rift valley where the crust has pulled apart as the planet has cooled and shrunk. And finally, you see some very deep basins. This is actually a very large impact basin called the Hellas Basin. There's another impact crater here. You can see this multi-ring appearance is a very large asteroidal impact that, in fact, busted through the crust. You flood the inner plane with lava. But what's interesting is the northern hemisphere of Mars. You notice how it's a lot lower? It's smoother. There's fewer craters than in the highlands of the south. So one of the things that's interesting about Mars is the northern portion of the planet is very, very low. It's thin crust. It's relatively recently formed. Recent meaning in the last, you know, few billion years, to be sure. Billion years or so on some of the younger portions. But it's depressed. It's somewhat reminiscent of thick continental crust is highlands, and that's reminiscent of an ocean basin crust on the Earth. If you made a similar map for the Earth, I looked and I couldn't find a good one for this lecture, you would find the continents would all be red and yellow, and the ocean basins would be deep blue. They would be depressed in shape. So this is very suggestive. Some people have wondered if Mars was wet enough to have a global ocean, or you could build somehow an ocean in the future, or terraforming or some science fiction-y thing. This is where your ocean basin would be, right? Water always flows to the lowest place. Let's go, however, to the surface. If we stood on the surface, if we could stand on the surface of Mars, we can't, but the Spirit Rover can certainly do that for us. What we see is a dry, rocky desert. This is a place called the Gusev. This is a plain near Gusev Crater. A couple things about the Martian surface. First of all, if it wasn't for a couple of these craters running around to kind of clue you in, this sort of desert reminds me of the really empty deserts in places like the worst parts of Death Valley, the Namib, desert of Africa, especially the Atacama Desert, or the high Atacama Desert of Chile. Very dry, pretty cold. However, that you're not on Earth is kind of clued in by the fact that the sky is kind of pink. The reason the sky is pink is because of all this, you know, dirty, rusty, iron oxide type stuff that gives Mars its red planet appearance, gets lofted by those dust storms into the high atmosphere and stays up as suspended aerosol particles. Have any of you ever lived in a desert or grown up in a desert place or visited a desert place and been experiencing of a dust storm? This kind of reddish appearance, if you've ever been in a dust storm, I've been in Arizona, I've been in a haboob a couple of times. It's an Arabic word that's used to describe these really massive dust storms. One of my younger brothers experienced dust storms in the Kuwaiti desert during the first Persian Gulf War. He was a tank driver for the army. And we both had the same description of feeling kind of we're in this kind of reddish place. And that's kind of what you get on Mars, but it's a lot thinner. You don't really get the deep, you know, gloom of Haboob, but you get the sort of general reddish appearance there. It does move the sand around. There are sand dunes. You see a lot of wind weathering. You see filling in of low places with loose sand that's blown around. But it's a dry, extremely cold desert. And by cold, really cold. It's mostly below zero most of the time. In temperatures there. And it's extremely dry. There's virtually no water on the surface of Mars or in its atmosphere. Now, the other thing about Mars is it's right now it is geologically fairly dead, but in the distant, not too distant past, Mars was pretty geologically active. We see a lot of signs of that, particularly a couple slides back of that altitude map. There are some very vast lava plains, that significant amount of secondary crust on the planet. We also see evidence of volcanism. In fact, one of those volcanoes is Olympus Mons. It's the largest volcano on any body anywhere in our solar system, hands down the winner. It's bigger than any volcano on the Earth, even some of the subsea ones that actually managed to burst through the ocean and make themselves known as islands. For example, Mauna Kea, Mauna Loa, the big shield volcano that makes the big island of Hawaii, doesn't hold a candle to Olympus Mons. It's 24 kilometers high. The highest mountains on Earth are 8 kilometers high. That's the top of Everest is a little over 8 kilometers. This is 24 kilometers high, three times higher than Everest. Why is it built up so much? The lower gravity on Mars lets you pile things up a bit more. It's a hot spot, so it's been building in place, just belch, build, belch, build, belch, build. The plate's not moving. It's a stationary hot spot. So it just has nothing to do but pile up. The base out here is 600 kilometers across. And to put that in scale, here's the state of Arizona superimposed upon the central caldera. That's the central cone where the lava used to flow out. And then the immense slopes here. Remember, we're looking straight down on an immense lava cone that's 24 kilometers above the surrounding plains. This thing is huge. The walls here, the cliffs around the outside, are miles high. It's a really amazing thing. I don't know if humans will ever go to Mars in my lifetime. I would want to go just to see Olympus Mons. It's got to be cool. Here's a close-up image of the inside of the caldera. You can see a few craters, but it's mostly smooth. There's a couple craters down here on the surface. From the relative paucity of craters, we can put an approximate date as to when this mountain was last flowing with lava, and the answer was about 300 million years ago. To put that in perspective, that's the equivalent of the Carboniferous period on the Earth. So imagine an Earth which has gone geologically inactive well before the dinosaurs even showed up. And this is part of why Mars is a dead planet today. Its geology is shut down because it's cooled off on the inside. It's solidified on the inside. That means if it loses carbon dioxide to, you know, just losses because its gravity is weak and due to the solar wind, there's no source of carbon dioxide to replace it. There's no volcanoes putting new atmosphere out there. And so what it loses forever. And that's part of the reason why Mars has the atmosphere it does today, is the shutdown in this geology. But this very active geology that we see the last remnants of, the last big gasp 300 million years ago, tells us that Mars had a geologically active past. And in that geologically active past was a significant atmosphere building capability. But over time, it's lost that atmosphere because it couldn't retain it. It's too small, even though it's cold. And as it turns out, it lost its magnetic field, and so it basically got subject to the buffeting from the solar wind. Now, the other piece of geologic activity that we see today are these immense channels. They're cut by these big valleys and channels. The biggest of these is called the Valles Marineris. It's a vast canyon. It's actually a rift valley. This is not like, it's often referred to as Mars's Grand Canyon, but there's a fundamental difference. The Grand Canyon was carved in the northern Arizona terrain by the action of the Colorado River over many, many years. This was carved by the crust pulling apart as the planet shrank in size. Okay, as it began to readjust itself to the changes as it cooled off, you open up these vast rift valleys. In Africa, for example, there's a vast rift valley that's opened up, which is analogous to this, but much, much smaller. Seems like everything on Mars wants to be bigger. This valley is 4,000 kilometers long. That's Boston to Los Angeles. It's between 2 and 7 kilometers deep. The Grand Canyon's not even close to that. And in some places, in the widest portion, it's 600 miles wide. So imagine standing on the edge of a canyon where the cliffs, cone down sheer, drop down 3 or 4 miles. And the other side of the canyon is hundreds of miles away. This is an immense, crazy valley. This is basically an example of faulting structures. So what we're seeing is a dynamic crust. But this, again, is a very ancient structure. There are craters across that we can use to approximately date it, and it's a few hundred million years old. So far, all we're seeing is geologic activity, but it's long dead geological activity. But the high-resolution imagers on Mars have begun to reveal some other interesting things on the surface, and that is the signs of flows of liquid water. The first of these were found with the Viking orbiter. When the Viking landers were sent, each of them was carried in a spacecraft that stayed in orbit. The lander detached and landed, and the orbiter stayed on orbit to take pictures of the surface while the landers were on the surface doing their initial measurements. They carried among the highest resolution cameras. They were landed in 1976, so they carried the highest resolution cameras of the time. And they revealed a series of interesting flow patterns here. Very, very deep channels that were not this kind of faulting and rifting apart, but actually signs where the land has been carved open. One of these deep channels, followed by floodplains downstream, are evidence of catastrophic flows. One of these here is called the Ravi Vallis. It's one of these long valleys. Here's the head of the valley. You can see craters around here, so you can see it swept through the terrain, which originally was heavily cratered, and wiped those craters out. What you see here is a tremendous catastrophic flood. It begins to tear out of water in this area here, which we think was flowing water. You see debris like large boulders. These are, building-sized boulders or larger strewn through there. And then once you get past the initial debris, you can see the very characteristic flows of erosion flows, of water erosion going through. But these are one-time flows. These are immense floods bursting forth, and then the water simply goes away. The analogy of this on Earth in North America is a place called the Scablands, up in Montana and in Idaho and places like that, where an immense glacial lake burst out and there was an immense flood downstream and leaves a series of debris across the badlands of that area that carved through that. That's an example of a catastrophic flow, and that in the case of the Scablands, it was a glacial lake which had an ice dam. The ice dam broke, and you get this sort of immense, epic flood. The question is, well, here's the signs geologically of an immense, epic, catastrophic, one-time flood. What triggered it? There's two possibilities. One possibility, maybe not for this one, but for another one, is a meteor strike nearby will melt subsurface ice, and suddenly you take a lot of ice, turn it into water, and you get it to flow. The other possibility is a volcanic eruption on that point. You get a magma hotspot form. As the magma works its way to the surface, it melts subsurface ice, and you get a sudden flood, but the flood stops when you run out of the source ice. So these are non-steady state catastrophic flows. We don't know the exact reason for each of these, but we see signs of those. They're important because they're a sign that there is significant amounts of water in the form of ice probably below the surface, and if you can rapidly melt large amounts of it by pumping in a lot of heat, and nowadays that's a meteor strike that will do that, you can get these sudden catastrophic flows. So for a while, what people thought was that what was notable was it was a sign of a lack of what we would consider a steady state flow. A steady state flow is like a river flowing out of a lake. Like the Mississippi River is an example of a steady state flow. And no one saw any evidence of those. But the scale of these is so big, they're easily seen by the first of the orbiters. Each subsequent orbiter that's gone to the planet has carried higher and higher definition cameras, the ability to see smaller and smaller features. And recently, with some of these new orbiters, we've begun to now begin to see the evidence of steady state flows. Steady state flow is like a river. This is an area called the Eberswalde Delta. There was a flow that enters from the top and then begins to meander outwards. If it wasn't for the color of this, this almost looks like the Nile Delta or the delta of the Mississippi River dumping into the Caribbean, except that you have to take away all the present-day water, and you leave behind the meandering mud flats as the river basically begins to fan out. So this kind of evidence here is very strong evidence of steady state kinds of flows, of actual long-term standing water on the planet. It's really exciting because we've only gotten this in the last few years and begun to see this was a lot more common on the surface. What we're starting to see in some of these higher resolution pictures are flow patterns that are evidence of relatively recent, by recent meaning at least few hundred million year kinds of things. We see rapid floods, we see gullies and quebradas, things like we see on Earth, like flood channels which are, whenever it rains it in the desert. Again, having grown up in a desert, we get these dry riverbeds, these dry gullies, and the Spanish word quebrada for a lot of them. completely dry most of the year. But if a big rainstorm comes, all the water from the surrounding mountains funnels down into them, and they're among the most dangerous places they want to be. You know, walls of water go blowing through these things, many tens of feet high. There's always some idiot in his four-wheel drive who gets taken out by one of those every monsoon season. And they look an awful lot like this. In fact, this photograph here, which is of Mars, showing one of these, you know, river-run gullies, when I first saw that picture, that looked like an aerial photograph of near where I grew up. Except for the fact there's no vegetation here. It very much resembles the type of steady state flows we see on the Earth. We also see in impact craters, we see signs of big flows where stuff has been perhaps subsurface ice just below the surface here has been melted and slumps and flows down in here. We see evidence of these impact crater flows. Some of them are quite old because of the presence of impact craters of 100 million years. But others are much more recent. Less than a few million years, at least. It's very difficult to use cratering much more fine-grained than a couple million years, so we can't be sure. We've certainly seen, because the orbiters now are making multiple passes over the planet, we've seen changes in terrains. Now, some of those changes in terrains have been basically landslides and things like that, so there's still a little bit of stuff occasionally slumps and falls over. No one's seen a modern flow yet, but they could exist. There's no reason to think they don't. So those are examples of liquid flows. Lots of water carving through channels with water-type erosion, at least in the past. The other evidence here is these are pictures now taken from the rovers, which can get right up close to the rock. And what they found inside some of these craters, where the craters have nicely dug a hole in the ground and revealed subsurface rock, is they find a lot of layered rocks. When we see layered rocks on the Earth, those are sedimentary rocks. Those are rocks that have been laid down of liquid-carrying sediments settling out layer after layer of water-deposited stuff. And it's exactly what you see here, these characteristic layering patterns that you see. There's also other pictures which are not visible in here, but which are seen in some other areas where you see various patterns which are called riprap patterns. They're patterns that you see where you get flows over the water where you get little pileups of sand. If you've ever looked at a riverbed, you'll notice riverbeds are not smooth. They have little ripple patterns of sand on the bottom. That's called riprap. We actually see riprap patterns. So you see more evidence close up, the microscopic forms of steady state flows. But it isn't just appearance. The rovers also carry geological analysis laboratories on board them. They could do basic spectroscopy of the rocks. They could do basic analysis and tell you what they were made of. And one of the things they found is that they contain a lot of salts, which is salts and hydrated minerals like hematite. Those are minerals that form in the presence of standing liquid water. Not sometimes flows. They have to be in standing liquid water. It's the salts that are important, though. Salts are what salts are. Generally, we think of salt, we think of sodium chloride. What a salt is a water-dissolved mineral, which as the water goes away, gets deposited and precipitates out of the liquid as it evaporates away or soaks into the ground. So if you have large amounts of salt deposits in a rock, you know that that was a place where there was standing water long enough to have dissolved minerals into the body, become perhaps even close to saturated with that, and then as the water begins to evaporate, the concentration of salts goes up, it saturates and precipitates. If you only have a little bit of water for a short time that just evaporates away, you don't have enough time to form salts because you don't have enough time to dissolve those minerals out of the rock. So the presence of salts, the presence of minerals that form in the presence of standing liquid water is very important. The problem is, we don't know how old these terrains are. We only think they're fairly old. They're probably fairly old. They've been dredged up by cratering. Don't know why that did that. So there's evidence that Mars has signs of standing liquid water on its surface in the past. So the first question is, if it had liquid water in the past, why don't we see liquid water today? Where did the water go? And the answer turns out that Mars right now today has a thin atmosphere. There's virtually no greenhouse effect. It's too cold for there to be liquid water on the surface. That's kind of what your problem three is about, is aiming at that. So where did it go? Well, if there's any liquid water, it's frozen out as ice. But Mars should have started out with a much hotter, heavier atmosphere than it has today. It had a geologically active interior, so it had a way to build that atmosphere. It had a magnetic field, so it didn't lose that atmosphere. However, as Mars began to cool off, the cooling went catastrophic on it because it was far enough away from the sun, the greenhouse effect was just barely able to keep the local temperatures above the temperature of liquid water. So what happens is, as the air temperature on Mars began to shrink, as Mars cooled off, the water vapor eventually, and liquid water, froze out. Freezing out means basically you freeze into the saturated rocks. You flow down and you freeze and you become subsurface water. Pretty soon you're freezing all the water vapor out of the atmosphere. You snow and then just sublimate right down into the ground. What you're left behind with is you scrub the water out of your atmosphere, leaving behind carbon dioxide and nitrogen. But Mars has a fairly weak gravity, and the carbon dioxide and nitrogen are actually able to just barely begin to escape. It's right on the line between being able to hold onto those gases and not. And so, yeah, instantaneously it holds onto them. But when you got billions of years, the atmosphere slowly but surely evaporates off the top. And there's nothing to replenish it because volcanism is shut down. So when you lose the atmosphere, you lose it for real. Finally, if that wasn't bad enough, as the interior solidified, you shut down convection in the deep interior, and you shut down the dynamo that gives it a magnetic field. We certainly expect that Mars rocks should have been magnetic in the past, or certainly a magnetic field. Geological laboratories are going to search for fossil magnetism in certain types of rocks, like we see on the Earth, to try to figure out when it lost its magnetic field. But whatever the case was, when Mars ceased to be geologically active, its magnetic field collapsed. And when the magnetic field collapsed, it exposed the upper atmosphere to the full brunt of the solar wind. And that took an already weak atmosphere, and you began to blow it off. And so Mars eventually got, as a result today, a very thin, very cold, bone dry, because it contains nearly no water vapor, carbon dioxide, and nitrogen atmosphere. But it should have started with an awful lot of water vapor by proportion to carbon dioxide. There's no reason to believe in our models of how planets form that Mars's atmosphere should have, primordial original atmosphere, should have been any different than that of the Earth, that of Venus, or even that of Mercury. Because we know that the rocks, the materials that made up the planet, were rich in water and carbon dioxide and other of these compounds. But we know it would have been dissolved in the molten rock. It would have come out as volcanism. So where did the water go? Well, the idea was that most people thought it kind of froze out below the ground, but we have no idea how much there should have been to start with. Maybe some of it's lost out as well. There's been a recent discovery in this map. This is a map of Mars. It's now, again, we're unwrapping the planet. But what they're doing is they're looking. This is actually the results from a gamma ray spectrograph, which was carried on one of the orbiters. Where you see these bright regions here is gamma ray returns scattering off of protons. Gamma rays scattering off of protons. Where are the protons? What's a proton? A proton is a hydrogen nucleus. So this is the presence of hydrogen. You want to know where Mars's water is? There it is. It's frozen below the surface. Now, what they expected for the gamma ray spectrometers is it would show an awful lot of, in fact, there's a huge amount. Notice the purple up here is the highest concentration of proton return. Where is it? Well, in this season, it was at the North Pole. We know the North Poles are made of frozen water ice. There's not much down at the South Pole. There's a little bit because it was summertime down there when this measurement was made. So what people expected from this experiment was, yeah, we'll see a lot of ice at the poles, and maybe we'll get some feeling from, you know, get a little bit of return from subsurface ice at other latitudes. What they didn't expect was there's a huge amount of low-latitude subsurface water ice on Mars. There it is. It's frozen out, and it's below the surface. Now, if it's frozen below the surface, if we go far enough back in the past, could it have been liquid? So let's sort of just quickly review where we're at on Mars. There are signs in the geology of former liquid water flows. Some of them are rapid catastrophic flows. Some of them steady state flows, gullies, rivers, deltas. But they're no longer carrying liquid water today. We see in the gamma ray spectroscopy substantial amounts of subsurface water. And the state of the current day atmosphere reflects a very different evolution because it's a small, cold planet that lost most of its atmosphere. It's frozen out. It's a frozen, dry desert. But if we turn the clock backwards, could Mars have been warmer and wetter in its past? Well, this is a highly speculative picture made by some science fiction buffs. But one can imagine, perhaps, when Mars was only a billion years old, you could have had oceans and weather and liquid water like on the Earth. Now, this is a highly speculative picture. Of course, what they've done here is they've taken the Mars terrain map, they've filled in the Valles Marineris. The Valles Marineris was not there 3 billion years ago, so this is a highly fanciful picture. But imagine we could somehow restore Mars's atmosphere. How would you do that? Bring it gases. How do you bring it gases? Smack it with comets. Lots and lots and lots of comets. You can build an atmosphere up. But wait, you say, why would you do that? It'll lose it. Yeah, it loses it over a few billion years. If we can build an atmosphere that's good enough for a million years, human beings have only been on the Earth for 100,000. That's enough time. Perhaps we could rebuild Mars. We could give Mars an atmosphere, get a greenhouse effect going, make it warm and wet. Or maybe in the past it looked like this. Now, not everybody thinks this. There are possible ways to make Mars always have had subsurface water, that it never really had standing water on its surface. So people kind of go both ways. There's different kinds of evidence that we're really only standing on the knife's edge of being able to understand. The next generation of rovers going to Mars are not just going to go trying to look for remnants of life. They're also going to be looking in detail at the Mars geology. What was the nature of water in that warm past? Was it liquid standing water, oceans and lakes? Or was it actually frozen subsurface ice, like a tundra, for example? We don't know, but certainly that's one of the aims of Mars exploration, is to find out. Questions? Okay, I'll see you all on Monday then. Have a good weekend.